The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, for another take on California, all Irish eyes will be on the Dolby Theatre in LA this Sunday night as our movie makers compete for coveted Oscars. Our first guest is very familiar with that world. Martin Nolan is the co-owner of Julian's Auctions, an auction house to the stars with sales in excess of $40 million last year. Martin found his way into the industry after years working with Chagask, banking on Wall Street, and also working as a hotel doorman in Manhattan. Martin, I know your world now is all about hanging out with celebrities and attending the Oscars and early morning dips at the beach in Santa Monica and all the rest of it, but it's a long way from where you grew up in rural County Roscommon, a few miles outside Athlone.
Absolutely. Very close to Hudson Bay, so close to the shores of Loch Ree, not quite the Pacific Ocean, but close enough. That's where
that
I
was your Santa Monica growing up, wasn't it?
And that's all I knew, and I loved it, so I didn't know any better. But yeah, I was lucky enough to grow up in a nice, close-knit community, very good parents. I knew, lucky to know, both my grandparents. In fact, I lived with one of my grandmothers for probably the first 5 years. I remember her very, very well. And then I had a granny in town where I used to go on my holidays into town to my granny in town. So I, you know, had good parents. I was one of seven kids. I had three brothers, three sisters, three older, three younger. So a good place to be. My father, who worked in the ESB in Athlone for many, many years, he was a very heavy smoker. He went to boarding school in Blackrock College in Dublin. And at age 11, he started smoking with the bigger boys and could never quit it. Sadly, he passed away of lung cancer. He'd been sick that I was aware of for probably about 6 months, but didn't realize it was terminal. It was like a tough time for my family because my mum at age 47 was left with seven kids. The youngest was four. He hadn't even started school. My sister was doing first year nursing. I too doing leaving cert, and then I was doing intercert. So there was a lot going on. It was June, and then my father seemed to have waited until we had finished our exams, and he passed away on June 24th of 1978. So that was a sad time. And, you know, today there's probably like grief counseling and there's like support to help somebody like my mother and my sisters and brothers. That wasn't the case at that time. It's just like you dealt with what you were, as my mother would say, you know, everybody gets something in life, some burden, some cross, some crisis that you have to deal with. It prepares you for life. Exactly. But, the sad thing about my father is like he was a strict disciplinarian. So I never got to really know him as an adult. He was quite a fun, popular person socially outside of the family unit. But at home, he was a traditional, strict father. I wish that, you know, if he had lived and I became an adult, that I would have got to know him as the person rather than being the father. But I have to give tremendous credit to my mother, who, at 47, you think if you're 47 and you have seven kids to raise. Luckily, my father, who worked in the ESB, had left us financially secure in the sense that we didn't have money issues. And there was a good pension support medical system with the ESB, which we're forever thankful for that. And my mother to this day is still, you know, she used to make our clothes as kids. No, she was brilliant. We used to joke in our house, the only singer in our house was the Singer sewing machine. But my mother was constantly sewing, and she'd make my sister's dresses for communion and for graduation. Yeah, she's a really tremendously good, solid lady.
When it came to thinking about jobs and the rest of your siblings, I mean, was there a sort of a drift towards, well, your dad had worked in the ESB, you know, we should get a job in the public sector in a nice, steady civil service type job?
Absolutely. So you have to think about Ireland in the 70s and the 80s when there wasn't a huge amount of choices as regards what career one would choose. So like my sister, oldest sister, she became a nurse. Then I had a brother who was in the army and then he went to London. There's always one in the family that goes to London typically. My next sister went to work in the bank. I had actually hoped to work in the bank, but I got a job in the civil service. I worked at on first Tlunthish, which then became Chagask, which I really loved. I was there for 6 years. In fact, of that 6 years, I took a year out and I went to Australia, and we can talk about that. And then my brother became a guard. And so, you know, that was the type of family we were. Was like, you know, get the good, solid, secure, stable job, but also a job where you're sort of contributing. Let's say, like my sister, who's still nursing, she's a hospice care nurse in Scotland. And that's a very special person to do a job like that.
There must have been something, though, about you working in Chagas. You'd got that job, a good job in the public sector, etc. And it could be a lifelong career job. But there must have been something about you that was kind of looking around for something different, because you ended up getting a US visa, a green card in a lottery. So you must have applied for it. Did you really want to go and see the world?
Yes, I was looking for something. My mother used to always instill upon us that this was her niche in the world, and we had to go out and find our own niche. So she gave us our wings. And in fact, at one stage, I think when I was in Australia, of the seven kids, six of us were away in Saudi Arabia and Austria and Australia and England and et cetera, et cetera. So we did go out into the world. And my mother would also say, hitch a wagon to the stars. I mean, she was thinking of the planets. I was obviously ended up working with the Hollywood stars.
Exactly. But before that, you got the green card, you went to New
yes.
York, and you worked as a hotel doorman for a while.
Absolutely. So I was working in Chagas. First of all, there was this lottery system going in America called Donnelly Visa. There was 10,000 visas. They received 19 million applications from 36 countries for initially 10,000 visas. My name came out as a reserve name. I never had any ambition to go to America. I had two uncles who lived in America. I'd never been to America. The odds of me getting a green card was so slim. I figured, I'm so lucky to have won, I should go. So I wasn't planning on staying or making a career. So I went into the Hilton Hotel and I went into the Human Resources Department and I said, you know, I'm looking for a job. And they said, what kind of job? I said, I'll do anything. And they said, when can you start? I said, I can start tomorrow. And I started as a bellman, 1,800 bedrooms. It was like incredible. The penthouse, at that time, the penthouse per night was $3,000, which was almost like a year's salary for me at the time when I was working in Chagas. So that was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So I was getting an hourly rate of $2.40 an hour, not enough to pay bills, but because I was a tip employee. Every day I'd go to work, I'd come home with, as the other bellman would say, a day's pay, I'd have at least $100 in my pocket. Then they made me a doorman because I was like 6'3" and they need tall, you know, doorman.
And a bit of chat as well.
And the chat. And so I met tons of Irish. I was there when they had Night of 100 Stars at Radio City Music Hall, which was across the street. And literally, the celebrities were just rolling in like it was, you know, mass on Sunday.
You met Muhammad Ali and Margaret Thatcher.
I had chats with both of them. In fact, one of my favorite people of all was Muhammad Ali, because he comes in, I'm standing there at the door, and he has his fists up to fight me. A skinny, tall Irish man. And of course, I reacted and put up the fight in Irish. I put the fist up as well. And then he loved that. And then he shook my hand. I had my gloves on. It was cold. And it was like my hand going into his hand. It was like my hand going into a shovel. He seemed to be like the biggest man I ever saw. And he was incredibly nice and funny. I'll never forget that moment. And then, of course, we had Margaret Thatcher come to visit. She was speaking at an economic forum for women at the Hilton Hotel. And so I met her at her green Jag that pulled up and racing green car. And she comes out just like Lady Thatcher you expect, in the little Chanel suit and the handbag sitting there and the hair exactly. And she was incredibly nice. I took her up to the penthouse. She was just so nice, and with her assistant was there, and I was tipped very generously, I would say, for very little effort. All I had to do was just point and take them to the right area.
There was plenty of room in the handbag for a large wallet, was there, for the tip?
Yeah, but of course the tip came from the assistant.
Okay. Duly noted, Ryan. And You then worked in banking in Wall Street.
If you're in New York, you're either fashion, finance or theater. I wasn't in fashion and I wasn't in theater. So finance was my thing. And I had, you know, worked in finance in Chagosk, and I had gone to school at College of Commerce, did accountants exams at night, etc. So I decided, well, I'm going to train to be a stockbroker, which I did. So I started in January of 1992. But really, it's like tough work. You know, the expectation was you'd be in the office at 8 o'clock in the morning. You don't leave until 8 at night. You were paid $5 an hour between the hours of 9 and 5.
$5 an hour?
Only for 8 hours. So the other hours, the other 4 hours in the day that you were there, you weren't paid for at all. So my actual monthly salary wasn't enough to cover my rent and my train fare into Grand Central Station. And so I kept on my job at the Hilton Hotel. I used to work Saturday, Sunday as a doorman at the Hilton. That was so that I have money to pay my bills and to survive while I went through the training program. I've actually never told my family that, because I didn't want them to think that I was in any way struggling.
From the outside, it sounds so glamorous. You know, you've got a job in banking in Wall Street and you're making your way in New York and everything is wonderful from the outside.
Exactly. And if I had made any effort to complain at home, I'd say, well, I should come home. And I should never have given up my good civil service job. So I had to stay the course, and you had to maintain like a, you know, Armani suits and Hugo Boss suits, et cetera, et cetera. You had a dress code. You were working in a boardroom. I was working in a boardroom with like 100 brokers, probably 95 of them were guys. And then I went to work for JP Morgan Chase and then eventually Merrill Lynch. So I worked with the best companies as a financial planner, working with high net worth individuals. And I was sort of in the rat race of it all. And, you know, I sort of look back and say it sort of robbed my youth as well. But when 9/11 happened, like that was, everyone in the city was impacted somehow. So it was a terrible time. But for me, it was a time to reflect, well, if I had perished, like what have I achieved? You know, what has Martin Nolan done? Like, what can I say that, I didn't make that chair or table or make that jacket or whatever. There was nothing that I could say that I'd left a mark. And so I started looking around for something more meaningful in my life. And in 2004, when I was at Merrill Lynch and I met Darren Julian, a gentleman who had started Julian's Auctions, I was trying to bring Darren on as a client of Merrill Lynch. And
he ended up hiring you then.
And he ended up hiring me because Darren is a tremendous marketing guy with zero respect or knowledge of finance. And I was the finance guy. And Julian's was very small, 5 people at the time.
And some of the things that the company has sold, the Marilyn Monroe dress that she wore when she sang Happy Birthday to JFK, that very, very famous dress. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so what's interesting about that, in 1999, when I was still working as a stockbroker, I was at JP Morgan Chase, and I used to subscribe to a stock picker's newsletter. Marty Zweig was his name, and every week there'd be a newsletter with his stock picks, et cetera, et cetera. And this is before we had internet and, you know, all of the technology we have today. And then suddenly I read that he had bought Marilyn Monroe's dress when she sang Happy Birthday to President Kennedy for a world record $1.25 million. And when he was asked why, he said it was as an investment. Now, I've been selling stocks and bonds and obviously was aware of real estate and art and even jewelry as part of an investment portfolio, but never heard of a dress. And so that was like a shock to me. You know, when I left Merrill Lynch, my managers were like shocked. They couldn't believe that I was leaving, not just to go to an auction house, but to a Julian's selling memorabilia. I mean, if it was Sotheby's or Christie's, they would have understood it, but not Julian's. Fast forward then to 2016, when the gentleman, Marty Zweig, who had bought that Marilyn dress, his wife came to us and said that her husband had sadly passed away, and that she had to sell the dress for estate purposes. And so it was on my bucket list as items to sell. And she said, all I hope for is that you sell it for more than my husband paid for it to prove that it, he was right, that it was an investment. And we sold it for $4.81 million November of 2016, which was four times what he had paid for it, which was incredible. And of course, we know, sort of, a lot of us are aware of the fact that, you know, we were involved then in helping our friend and client Kim Kardashian to wear the dress at the Met Gala in New York in May of last year. That dress today, Richard, would probably sell now for $10 million.
Wow.
Other things that the firm has sold, Kurt Cobain's guitar and William Shatner's kidney stone.
I can just
picture that in a display case on the dining room table.
Beam me up. Well, Richard, at Julian's Auctions, we leave no stone unturned. And we were very happy to. William Shatner, he's a friend, and I know him for many, many years. He was always asking us, you know, to do an auction. He wanted to raise money for charity. And he was on Jimmy Kimmel show one evening, and Julian saw him on the show, and he was talking about that he had a kidney stone removed recently. And so Darren thought, wow, that's it. So he contacted Shatner, and he said, you know, why don't we sell your kidney stone? And he said, Julian, it's disgusting, but I love it. And so we sold it, would you believe, for $75,000, and all of the money went to Habitat for Humanity. It was after those devastating hurricanes, Katrina and Rita, in New Orleans, I think 2005, 2006, somewhere around then.
And what's it like to know a lot of these famous celebrities, Martin? I mean, you're talking about, you know, my friend who I know, our friend Kim Kardashian, William Shatner. I mean, you know, do you tell your mother back home in Roscommon who you were having lunch with, or this is the latest person I've met? Does she enjoy that?
She loves the updates from Hollywood. Now, my mother, she grew up in Athlone Town, and so she used to go to the cinema, and she loved the movies, and she used to have a scrapbook, which we're still looking for to this day, let me tell you, because it could be valuable, but she used to keep a scrapbook about all the Hollywood stars and the glamour and Greta Garbo. And she, in fact, sometimes if I'm working with a celebrity, like recently we were contacted by Kim Novak, who really, I don't really know who Kim Novak was. So I'm able to call my mother, and she usually knows. And if she doesn't know, she gets on the iPad and she'll research it, and then I'll get the update. So she's a good support for us.
She's got her finger on the pulse there, Mark.
And not only that, if a celebrity dies, I get an email immediately, and I have to remind her, Mum, we wait 7 days before we reach out to any families of estates.
That's a good business lead, yeah. She's giving you a business lead.
Exactly. So, yeah, my mother loves the updates. She's met Lady Gaga, and she was very cool with that. She told Lady Gaga that she liked her perfume, and Lady Gaga said, yes, isn't it sexy? I was like, not sort of the word you use with my mother, but Lady Gaga got away with it.
Am I right in saying you introduced her to some of the cast of Dallas?
Yes, in fact, all of the cast, all the main characters of Dallas. And in fact, Linda Gray has stayed in my mother's house a few times. I'm very good friends with Linda Gray. Larry Hagman's been there. Charlene Tilton has stayed in my mother's house a few times. My mother taught Linda Gray how to bake brown bread. So, and you know, when I think about when we were growing up and watching Dallas, when the world stopped while you watched Dallas, and then to see Larry Hagman sitting there beside my mother, or Linda Gray, you know, coming in with a bunch of flowers for my mother. And so I put them at ease. I chat them. I charm them. They enjoy that.
And is that the thing, Martin? Because I was going to ask you about what makes the business work for you. Where's that real skill? Because you get to sell this stuff only because you get the gig as opposed to some other memorabilia auction house. And is that about, you know, word of mouth? Is it about the contacts and relationships you have? How do you do that? How does it work?
It's been out there meeting with the clients, meeting with them on a personal level, putting them at ease. You want, because when we do go to do an auction for whoever it is, you're going to be competing against Sotheby's, Christie's, Bonhams, the major houses. And, you know, we're going to celebrate 20 years in business this year. Sotheby's and Christie's are around for almost 300 years, as is Bonham's. So they've been doing it a long time. But what's different about Julian's is they get to sit down with the owners. So Darren, Julian and I co-own Julian's Auctions. So they get to sit down with the owners. They talk about the business plan, the marketing plan, the commissions involved, etc. And the decisions are made right there with them, where the auction would be, when the auction would be.
There are cases where you might end up pursuing something that doesn't come to fruition. I'm thinking of one example was you went to Michael Jackson's Neverland. What happened there?
So 2008, I was working on the estate of Bob Hope. I'm working at Bob Hope's house. His wife Dolores was still alive at the time. And we were doing an auction for Bob Hope. And we got a call from Michael Jackson's manager about potentially doing an auction. We thought it was a storage unit. Came to be that it was, in fact, the auction for Neverland. And this was mid-July. And we, at that time, we had to have everything out of Neverland by August 30th because the property was being foreclosed on. So we had to go to work really, really quickly, hire 30 men working 7 days a week at Neverland. Because Neverland was like 2,700 acres, phenomenal. 35 acres of that was the home, the office, the theater, the teepee village, the animal shelters, all of the rides, the carousel, etc. So a massive undertaking. We were chosen to do the auction. It took us actually until October until we actually got everything out of there. Massive amounts of garden statuary and huge numbers of vehicles and Rolls Royces, etc. It was five catalogues of items to be included in that auction. We were in fact at the Museum of Style Icons in Newbridge to promote the auction, which was set to take place mid-April in Beverly Hills. And at the same time, we read online on TMZ that Michael Jackson's manager had filed a lawsuit to say that we had stole his property. So that was an absolute nightmare. We had to hire lawyers in the middle of the night from Ireland to Los Angeles to go into court and get a stay order so that we could continue on promoting the auction, doing what we were doing.
And how did it finish up, Martin, in the end?
It finished up very nicely because we realized that Michael didn't want to do the auction anymore because he had got a nice check from AEG for signing to say that he was coming back to perform. He didn't need to do the auction anymore financially. If the auction had gone ahead, it would have been massively successful and financially rewarding for us. But we understood if Michael Jackson wants his stuff back, we're not going to force the auction.
And it has never been sold, has it, the stuff?
We recreated Neverland in Beverly Hills, an amazing exhibition. And then April 25th, we gave everything back to Michael, went into storage. 8 weeks later, Michael passed away. And the stuff is still in storage. Now, incredible, because the estate wanted to wait until the kids were old enough to make an adult decision about what they want to do with all of those items. And in fact, last week I was in New York. I was at the Michael Jackson show on Broadway, tremendously successful and enjoyable. And I was there with Prince Michael, so Michael Jackson's oldest son. And we had a great chat. And I started off the conversation by telling him, I cleared out your bedroom. And he said, what? And then I had to explain to him what had happened and where the bedroom was. I told him I'm from Athlone. And he said, I have great memories of Ireland. I said, yes, you were about 11 miles away from me in Grouse Lodge near Moat in County Westmeath. And he said, yes, I was just in touch with George recently. And he said, I had so many memories. I said, yes. And you remembered, like, Michael and the kids used to go to Smith's Toy Store in Athlone, and they went to the Bastion Gallery and places like that. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take you back there. We're going to go back and, we'll visit all these places. He said, my girlfriend's family are from Ireland. Her name is Holly. Lovely, lovely girl. And she said, my grandfather was from Ireland, from Kerry. And she said, the name of my dog growing up was McGillicuddy. So, like,
it sounds like you might get that sale over the line in the end anyway, will you?
And that's my goal. I have the catalogues all done. I'm ready to go.
Well, Martin Nolan, co-owner of Julian's Auctions in Los Angeles, it's been a pleasure. You've come on an amazing career journey from outside Athlone in County Roscommon to hanging around with some of those stars in Los Angeles. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Richard.